From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. U.S. forces have reportedly killed the leader of the Islamic State, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, in a raid in northwestern Syria. In a triumphant national address to the nation, President Donald Trump announced the killing in his trademark style of bragging, denigration, and exaggeration. The announcement came at a politically useful moment for Trump, who has come under rare criticism from his own party for pulling U.S. troops back from northern Syria. To find out more about what this all means, we turn to Rahul Mahajan. He is the author of two books on the Iraq War, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He also teaches at University of Wisconsin, River Falls, and he is the U.S. Foreign Policy and Empire Correspondent for our program. Welcome back to the show, Rahul.
Great to be with you, Sonali.
So who was Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi? He never sort of received as much of the notoriety as Osama bin Laden, perhaps because he wasn't around for as long as bin Laden was. But essentially, this killing is being seen as Trump's moment in the same way that Obama enjoyed a victory, if you will, a political victory when bin Laden was assassinated. So who was al-Baghdadi?
So al-Baghdadi was, as far as we know, a sort of Islamic academic. He did a doctorate in Islamic studies and presumably would have lived out a life in relative quiet obscurity had it not been for Bush's invasion of Iraq and the various things that happened afterwards. He, like many Iraqis, he spent time in Camp Bucca and also in Abu Ghraib. He was already radical. It's not that he was radicalized there, but he certainly was given the opportunity, especially in Camp Bucca, to radicalize many other people. And in fact, according to some stories, was one of the architects of sort of segregation of people within the camp into separate Sunni and Shia groups so that he could then harangue the Sunnis over their insufficient orthodoxy. And I guess we would not have heard much more of him had it not been for the power void created in Iraq that allowed ISIS to emerge and set up what it called an Islamic State, beginning with the proclamation in Mosul in 2014 that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was the new caliph. So the restoration of the caliphate, which was ended in a formal sense in 1923. So it was sort of a major step in the, at least rhetorically, in the evolution of a new kind of transnational political Islam, although it really took its, you know, it really was very territorially focused. And so then, while various powers sat around and twiddled their thumbs, ISIS was able to spread over a considerable part of Iraq and Syria and institute rather draconian rule. And he was the man in charge. And there are a wide variety of crimes they committed, many of which he is known to have engaged in personally, and now apparently he's dead.
Syrian Kurdish forces also announced that in a joint military raid with U.S. forces a day later, they killed a man who was thought to be his aide and a potential successor. So the raid itself and the way in which it was described as having happened is one that has already taken on a lot of drama. And I recall in the weeks and months after bin Laden's death, U.S. raid in that part of the world, that was in Pakistan, was lionized and movies have been made about it. I imagine this will take on a potentially similar sort of mythical, approach. But Trump and his speech really, I think, painted this picture of what took place. I don't know how much of any of that is true. Of course, Trump is known for lying. That's the one thing we can count on him to do. One of the things that I noticed has not been made much of was that al-Baghdadi reportedly dragged three children with him as he was running away from U.S. troops. And then when he blew himself up, he killed the three children as well. Do we know anything about the details around his death?
Well, I think all we know are whatever has been reported to us. I don't think it's completely implausible, okay? I mean, it is certainly true that many people who have similar beliefs to al-Baghdadi consider that it's better to be a martyr than to, obviously
be
alive
in his
custody, right? So it's completely plausible. I have no idea if it's true. I don't know that it's worth speculating about. The sort of triumphalist account of the story, I think it's important to remember that no matter what movies get made later on, this is not a movie. And this so-called triumph, if that's what it was, comes after 5 years of grinding misery, oppression, the destruction of entire communities like the Yazidis in Iraq, that, you know, was basically, it was in its formation, was enabled by the United States, was put down largely with the efforts of Kurdish troops on the ground with U.S. air support, who Trump has now chosen to abandon, betray, and mock. I mean, it's interesting, you know, betraying the Kurds is just sort of a standard component of U.S. foreign policy. But when Ford and Kissinger betrayed the Iraqi Kurds in 1975, when George Bush Sr. enabled genocide against the Iraqi Kurds in 1988, when Bill Clinton betrayed the Kurds in 1996, and George Bush betrayed them once again in the aftermath of the Gulf War, they didn't also laugh at them. You know, adding the insults and the talk about how they're not really angels, that is a truly Trumpian touch that makes his betrayal, you know, sets it apart, gives it his own special stamp.
So Trump did, in fact, refer to the video of the raid that he watched as if it was like watching a movie. And he has said that he may release or authorize the release of parts of that video, which will again feed into this, the kind of triumphalism that he is hoping to generate. And I want to pick up on what you were saying about how this whole raid, what the political backdrop to it was. So weeks earlier, Trump announced this abrupt pulling back of U.S. troops from northern Syria, which, of course, very obviously exposed the Kurds. And we've seen now what Turkey has done in that area. Amnesty International has said that there are evidence of war crimes having been committed. And it was really those Kurdish forces that had very directly led to the defeat of ISIS and presumably to the intelligence gathering that led to the killing of al-Baghdadi, right? So Trump seems to have won some political victory with al-Baghdadi's killing, literally at the expense of the allies that the U.S. counted on.
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, I know he's trying to make it into a big political victory, but I think it is coming so soon on the heels of his very overt betrayal of and bad-mouthing of the Kurds to the point that it's going to be very hard for him to get much triumphalism out of anyone except his own increasingly, you know, bizarrely out of touch base.
So the killing of al-Baghdadi and the second in command, we assume this other person who was killed was a close aide, potential successor. Where does that leave ISIS? And there's already speculation that al-Baghdadi's killing will not actually necessarily hamper the organization in a huge way, that it's likely to simply regroup. What do you think?
Well, so ISIS now has no territorial base, so all of this may be irrelevant in a sense, but it is true. The one thing that al-Baghdadi represented that was a little bit new is it's one thing simply to be the leader of the group that, you know, so in Al-Qaeda, members came and swore allegiance to bin Laden. It's another to declare yourself the caliph, which means among other things that you have to be able to trace your descent to the Banu Hashim, the family of the Prophet. So not everybody can make a plausible claim to that. So maybe it may be a little bit difficult to get a successor who can also proclaim himself caliph. But then again, when they have basically no territorial base left, that is not terribly meaningful. Certainly finding another organizational leader will not be difficult.
And with the betrayal of the Kurds in northern Syria, what about all of those Islamic State prisoners that were being held? There, I understand, is going to be some attempt for Turkey to take over. But it seems as though either those prisoners are going to escape and potentially regroup, but we've heard some reports of that happening in some of the prisons, or they're simply going to be locked up forever with the key thrown away. The New York Times has been doing some really interesting reporting of what's been happening inside those ISIS prisons, who they are, including the imprisonment of children that ISIS fighters had brought with them. So specifically in northern Syria and those ISIS prisoners that were captured, do you have any sense of what's happening with them?
Again, nothing really beyond the occasional news report. They were in limbo. They were in a kind of a black hole. The Kurds were holding them in a provisional arrangement, the kind of provisional arrangement that is all too likely, especially in that area, to become permanent. I mean, you can ask the Palestinians in refugee camps about that. So now it's all unclear. To the extent that Turkey takes over custody, we'll definitely want to know how many of those people remain in custody. It's not as if Erdogan has some kind of perfect alignment with ISIS, but it's also not as if he is unwilling to use extremists of the same kind of ideological bent for his own purposes. So basically, everything is in complete flux. And I guess the one thing that that in a way the Trump critics should remember is that nobody else was putting forward solutions. Now, Trump's way of dealing with an intractable problem is to make it worse. But this was a problem that was potentially intractable for which nobody really had any clear ideas about what to do. So, and this is what happens when you create some group of people who are basically like pirates, persona non grata, in every country. And of course, naturally, because it was a state and meant to be, I suppose, a thousand-year Reich, there were children. And at the very least, they need to be given a home someplace, somehow. But then which country is running forward to volunteer to do that? The countries that have housed a lot of people from the area are, you know, have taken on a pretty thankless job. Turkey, for example, has 3.5 million Syrian refugees, and with, you know, minimal help from the rest of the world, the United States and Europe don't seem particularly willing to do very much about it directly.
Now, what about the fact that the Syrian Kurds, because of Trump's actions, have essentially been forced to ally with the Syrian government and, of course, Russia, which is backing the Syrian government? How will that change the dynamics in that area, in that part of the world?
It is just the slight intensification of a very long-standing, at this point, alliance. The Syrian Kurds have been in effective alliance with the Syrian government for some time. Of course, it is an artifact of the fact that Assad has not been able to have any sort of plausible way to reestablish complete territorial control. It's not as if he wants the Syrian Kurds to be effectively independent or autonomous. But given that they were willing to ally with the regime and be some sort of counterweight against the various components of the mostly Sunni Syrian opposition, they work together. The Syrian government paid the salaries of officials in the Kurdish region. Without that kind of thing, it would have been very difficult for them to keep administering things. So this is a long-standing arrangement, and of course they're also effectively allied with Russia. It may seem surprising to some, but the fact that the United States was allied with the Syrian Kurds doesn't mean anything in terms of Russia, because it's routine for the United States in the region to ally against itself, to ally with forces that are fighting against it, to ally with two different forces that are fighting each other. It's just unfortunately incredibly common. So this is just now, if the Kurds wanted to emancipate themselves, now it's impossible. There is no other patron. But it's not clear that they did, because nobody has some expectations that the United States is willing or able to remain a significant player in the region for the long term.
So U.S. troops that were pulled out of northern Syria were sent to Iraq, neighboring Iraq, and the Iraqi government has made it very clear to Defense Secretary Mark Esper that they do not want those troops there for the long haul. And interestingly, of course, the Iraqi government is itself facing a very serious political challenge right now with mass protests within Iraq. So I want to turn, Rahul, in the next part of our conversation to what seems to be a resurgence of the Arab Spring movement that broke into view in 2011. I remember you and I talking quite a lot during that time on the air about countries like Tunisia and Egypt, and of course Syria's own uprising, which then devolved into this very brutal war that the Assad regime has waged on it. So now we're seeing these resurgences in countries like Iraq, where people are speaking up and protesting en masse, and they're facing crackdown from the governments, and also in Lebanon, mass protests. So in Iraq specifically, how do you explain what is happening there in terms of seeing the uprising there as part of a sort of Arab Spring pro-democracy movement?
In Iraq right now, we've had some sort of parliamentary democracy with at least theoretical possibilities of alternation in power ever since the demonstration elections of the Bush years. But we haven't seen any change in terms of responsiveness of the government to the needs of people. We haven't seen any ability for them to, completely shut down violence and provide general security for people. And so they're very tired, but the protests in Iraq are still kind of nascent. It's too early for us to say whether they're really going to build. I mean, what's going on in Lebanon, conversely, has gotten to a massive level and indicates a very widespread dissatisfaction, not just with institutional sclerosis and the parlous state of the economy, but also basically with every political actor. They are very explicitly, first of all, they're reviving the slogans of the Arab Revolution, Ashab Yurid Iskat al-Nidham, which means the people want the fall of the regime. And they're also adding their own, all of them means all of them. Which is to say, it's an uprising against the entire political class considered as a unit, and in favor of something, presumably they don't know what, but something new. By the way, I'd also add to this Sudan.
And I want to get to Sudan in just a minute, but just staying in Lebanon for a minute, protesters over the weekend, we heard reports they formed a human chain across the entire country. And the central bank governor has now said that the country is just days away from economic collapse if there's no political solution. In the meantime, the situation is a little bit, this is what Al Jazeera pointed out, quote, difficult and delicate for Hezbollah. Where do you think this could head there? I mean, are we looking at a potential Egypt-style revolution, or, you know, something like what happened in Syria, where the government decides to push back really hard? Although, of course, Lebanon doesn't have as much of a history of that as Syria does. It's more democratic, I should say.
So it's, you know, prediction is difficult, especially about the future. So right now, Lebanon is suffering from, you know, basically a collapse of the public, of government protection of the public. I mean, if you can believe it, more than half of children in Lebanon are in private schools because basically nothing public works. The government, half of the government budget goes to debt servicing. They have to float bonds just to pay the interest on the bonds they've just floated. They're paying 15% and more in yields, which is just phenomenal, right? So basically, and at any time they try to do anything about it, like, for example, the infamous WhatsApp tax or the tobacco tax, of course, it is going to cause severe anger among the people. And you've got every single political element seems institutionalized and ossified and corrupt, including, I think, for many of them, Hezbollah. And you're seeing something new, too, which is sort of overt statements against the extreme sectarianism of the system, which is basically you know, everything about your political activity is defined by confessionalism, what your faith is, and it has tended to keep the same sort of people in power. For example, the Speaker of the Parliament, Nabih Berri, has been the leader of the Speaker and the leader of the Shia political party for 27 years. So it is definitely, it's something, it's not nothing, it's not just a minor episodic uprising. If it does lead to fall of the current government, it is very hard to imagine that it will lead to a new government that involves anything more than just a reshuffling of the elements. Unlike in Egypt, there is such a sort of breadth and diversity of the various different kinds of sectors that are represented in political power, who knows where you would look, right, for anything truly different. And even if you get away somehow from a confessional basis, which is the basis of the sort of fragile and not always existing peace that Lebanon has had since the Taif Accords of 1989, you're still going to need substantial representation of all these different groups. So it's very likely to lead to significant changes, at least in rhetoric or in terms of announcements. I think it is unlikely to lead to a governmental transition, even of the kind that Egypt had briefly. But that's just a guess.
You brought up Sudan, which had a very powerful and months-long rebellion that resulted in the overthrow of the Bashir regime there. Now people are protesting for a fall of the party that Omar al-Bashir was part of. There is some optimism there. And I know we have just a few minutes left. So I want to throw in a second question about a completely different country in there, which is Tunisia, one of the birthplaces, it's been considered, the Arab Spring, which just had elections and elected an outsider. And Tunisia is being seen as a potential success story to how an Arab Spring revolt can result in positive democratic rule. So brief thoughts on where Sudan is right now and where Tunisia has come.
Well, Sudan has, you know, what was overthrown was, again, a much narrower power structure. And I think, in general, in cases like that, there is significantly more opportunity for major structural change than there is in Lebanon. With regard to Tunisia, I mean, it is a qualified success story, but it's a success in the sense that it has had significant severe threats of the institutional order already since 2011 and has somehow managed to come up with, you know, temporary solutions and kind of get back on track. There was a point at which secular and leftist parties feared that Islamists were taking over, instituting Sharia, instituting a reign of terror against leftist political opponents. And and instead of this devolving into chaos, it was rescued somewhat oddly by the participation of these four civil society organizations, the National Dialogue Quartet, that shared the Nobel Peace Prize for their efforts to get Tunisia, a temporary technocratic government, and then later resumption of elections. Where things are going now is unclear. The guy Nabil Karoui, who lost, is more of a liberal figure, but also potentially a corrupt businessman who's actually under investigation. And the guy who won, it seems to be some sort of winning on a kind of charismatic appeal. He's a conservative Islamist. He somehow swept the youth vote. One thing to note about Tunisia also is that despite the fact that it is a success in the fact that it still has some kind of democracy, it was also the country that per capita sent the most people to join ISIS. Something like 5,000 Tunisians joined ISIS. So they have a lot of issues that they are dealing with as well. And what the victory of this relatively conservative Islamist, but not extremist outsider, Kais Saied, will bring is completely unclear at this time, especially since he doesn't have those institutional political links. Right.
Rahul, thank you so much for sharing your expertise on such a wide variety of these Middle East nations, Arab nations, and Muslim majority nations. I really appreciate all that you do. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Rahul Mahajan. He's the author of two books on the Iraq War, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He also teaches at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls, and he is our U.S. Foreign Policy and Empire Correspondent. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Do follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.